You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Living on Gumbunya country in Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sandy. It's good to be back with you on Talk the Walk after a long unintended break. You might remember that I relocated to New South Wales in January and my recording equipment was mistakenly packed up and loaded onto a shipping container, which went into storage for 3 convenient months. Well, thank goodness it's finally back into my safe little hands. And I'm pleased to be talking today with another very passionate person who oversees amazing work with vulnerable families in remote communities of the Northern Territory. Malcolm Galbraith is the manager of FAST-NT, otherwise known as Families and Schools Together, an evidence-based early intervention family strengthening program. Under Mel's leadership, FAST has grown from delivering in 6 community sites in 2009 to currently 20 sites per year. Mel, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure. It's really nice to be here with you, Lucy.
That's a fantastic achievement, FAST being delivered in over 20 schools in the top end. Over my time in the Territory, I can honestly say I was really impressed by the way FAST developed and expanded, built a really solid reputation in community and secured ongoing funding in what can be a very tricky work environment. So, Mel, what do you think attributes to the success of FAST up there?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's a question my staff often kick around because we actually need to understand what it is that works well. As you've indicated, we have an evidence-based program, which means effectively that people have thought about what works well and then put it into practice and tested it and seen a certain set of outcomes come out repeatedly. What we've done is taken that program and brought it into the context of the Northern Territory in a significant way. I think one of the key things is the underpinning principles of the program, and I think those underpinning principles work across cultures. Those underpinning principles are sympathetic to people. What do I mean by that? We hear a lot of people talk about being strengths-based and child-centred, etc., etc. But our FAST program actually does that. I guess, Lucy, it's a little bit like there's a saying that we're using at the moment to capture a bit of how we work, saying your method is your message. So it's actually how you work and your practice and what you do is really significant. And that's what people see. You can talk about how you work. You can have the best literature in the world, but it's actually how you work. So I guess values comes into it very significantly for us.
So when you're talking about the method, what does that look like in the communities where FAST is working?
So the design of the program is that my staff in here in Darwin and some staff in East Arnhem, out in the communities of East Arnhem, we are trained in how to run the FAST program. Be it baby FAST or kids FAST. Kids FAST aiming at families with primary school age children. So the first step is for us is when we either being asked to come into a school community or a local community or a suburban school here in Darwin or Palmerston, we build a local collaborative team and then we train that team of people how to run the program. Those people, they know their community. So they may not be the experts in their field. In fact, some of them are not qualified in terms of tertiary education processes, but they actually understand their community and they've got relationships. Mm. We also have, alongside local people in the community, we will have agency workers, youth workers, social workers, maternal health nurses, etc. So that little team of people are then trained to run the program. That team of people then invites the families to come in. We definitely try not to point out or target families. A lot of our government funding goes specifically targeting families who are so-called not doing well. You could even say dysfunctional. I guess for us, you could say hands up all the dysfunctional families. Well, everybody should put up their hand. So families don't feel judged and they don't feel they're getting it wrong. So that's where it is strengths-based. Once we train that team and they invite their families in, they then run a program for 8 weeks. Going for a couple of hours each night for 8 weeks, and there's a whole series of activities based around really empowering the parents to be in control and in leading their children, helping and just helping to run activities. And then incorporating that, we're incorporating listening skills, we're incorporating such old-fashioned values as delayed gratification, helping our children to wait and to be patient, teaching families how to discuss about feelings and sharing their feelings, teaching parents how to engage in child-directed play, where the children are actually creating the play from whatever they're doing, and the parents are really just supporting and guiding and encouraging the child. There's a parent group in the program for about 45 minutes. The kids go off and have kids' time, but then the parents sit around in a supportive parent group, which is supposed to be more of a self-help group, where we want people to share what they're doing well and share challenges and how they can support each other. Again, not necessarily a program where we're coming in and telling people how to do things. We really want to work with the assets of the families themselves. In that process, people see where they can fit. And I guess, Lizzie, I've been out to a few communities in different parts of the territory around the Katherine region and in East Arnhem. And when we're consulting or trying to set up the team, when we say to people, this is a program for you to run for your people, you can often see people's lights come alive because they're not necessarily being told what they have to do.
What difference have you seen that it makes to parents when they are invited to participate in that way?
It's an interesting thing. I was doing some youth work, strengths-based training a few years ago, youth work training around working with challenging youth. And he started the training on the first day by saying, who's here as a free person or who's here as a prisoner? Effectively implying who's been told to come by their manager or who's here because they want to be here. And I've got to tell you, I found that an incredibly interesting question to start a training, because you could see over the next 4 days which of those people were there because they wanted to be there and which people were there because they were being told to go by their line manager. So it's the same concept for families. If we're wanting families to come along, you have to help families to see why they want to come along. I guess one of the schools of psychology, you could say, I learnt this doing youth work years ago, was around Viktor Frankl and his rationale and thinking about if you know your why, you'll find your how. And therefore, if you can walk with families and they can identify what they want for themselves, they'll join in and they'll come.
I was wondering if you could speak about outcomes, because we know that funding bodies, they like outcomes. What is it that FAST sets out to achieve, and what sort of results are you getting?
Yeah, that's a really tricky area, and it takes up a lot of our time. And for operational program deliverers, it really requires us to work sometimes with skill sets that we don't have in terms of evaluation, and certainly we don't have the time to put into it around the program delivery, but we work hard. So essentially the program is trying to build family cohesiveness. The program is trying to empower parents to be strong leaders in their homes. It's effectively trying to increase the social connectedness with parents, with their own family around them, so they're not isolated, increasing their relationships with the school community, and then broadly further beyond that. So there's a whole range of things that we're looking to measure through the various evaluation processes we've tried over the years, and we keep tinkering and working in trying to find the best tool to use to capture that. I'll have parents say things like to us, I feel comfortable to actually come into the school.
That's great.
Which is a huge statement. We have parents both in urban communities of Darwin, urban suburban schools, and also remote schools out in the communities. Parents will say, my children listen to me more. We will get teachers saying they notice the unhelpful behaviours in the class diminish, etc.
You've alluded to the fact that the program is doing really well. If we can take a step back, and you've already sort of suggested that people feel comfortable to come because they're invited in and there's a sort of no preconceived expectation. Can you talk a little bit more about engaging families? Because often that's really tricky for people working in this context.
Lucy, I think part of the key to that is the design of the program. It's actually about the local team for a start. So if I'm training a team in one of our suburbs here in Darwin, it's that team who knows the families. So it's those people who stand at the front gate and chat with families. It's those team members and school partners who journey every day together. It's not as a service provider. I guess one of the key things in FAST is we don't see ourselves as service providers. We see ourselves much more as we try to come from a community development, empowerment, capacity building approach rather than providing a service, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So that's really significant. If I talk about our Eastern, like our more remote work and working in Aboriginal communities, what we've done significantly is trained. We've got about five people in East Arnhem who we've trained in how to train the FAST program. So therefore, the program gets trained in language, and that is significant. I guess what we've seen over the years, and our funding budgets don't reflect this, that when we're working in a remote community, we like to have our mainstream Darwin-based trainer working very close partnership with our Yolngu-based trainers because we bring different skill sets. For most of our Yolngu trainers, the process involved in data recording and report writing and understanding the framework from expectations from the dominant culture are really difficult and outside their grasp. But at the same time, if I walk into an Aboriginal community, I don't understand the dynamics, I don't understand the kinship structures, I don't have language to understand the significant meaning behind words and the different processes that are happening. So I guess intentionally over the last 6 years, we've worked very hard to work two up as trainers, bringing, I guess, in a way, two skill sets together to help maximise engagement.
Mel, in preparation for this interview, you sent me a photo of a piece of artwork that represented the culmination of several years' work with your Yolngu staff who are employed within FAST. And I will post that image on the blog so that people can take a look at it. Mel, what is it about this artwork that is significant for you or the FAST program?
It sounds a really easy question, but it's a complex answer, I guess, in a way, because it's actually describing years of work. It's describing years of many people's work, where we've engaged people who've got a lot more study of Aboriginal understandings than my staff do. But importantly, it's our staff working mostly alongside our Yolngu staff, and then those Yolngu staff going to their elders and talking to understand. So what we kept finding was that we, from a dominant culture, mainstream Western, there's a mouthful of a set of cliches. From a Western perspective, we've got an evidence base around, and we've got research theories around what family development looks like. And it's clear that Yolngu has those, they also have structures of thinking and plans around how building families looks like. They're just described differently in different languages. So we could take a concept like Bronfenbrenner's ecological development of children, and we could share that talking and understanding, and our Yolngu staff would come back with a story. And so we found that there was lots of stories that were matching. So we ended up with these metaphors. So if you look at the picture, it's got down the bottom of the picture, it's got three people in a canoe. Now that canoe is symbolism of my staff would be happy for me to talk about this, even though it's a very traditional story. They would talk about it in the fact that they're going turtle hunting, and so each of the people in the boat would have a different role. So it's about collaboration, it's about working together, and that when they actually do their job well and are successful, when they hunt, they catch the turtle, bring it back. Back in the day, not so much now because life has changed in remote communities a lot, the whole family, the whole village, the whole community was fed by the turtle. So therefore, it became a metaphor of if we do the right thing, work together, go in the right direction, we'll have success. So that becomes quite a concept, like quite a complex concept to understand, even though I've broken it down into a one-minute description. The basket up the top called Bhatti in Yolngamatha, and we can talk about the Bhatti helps to hold children. It's a bit like a nest concept, but there's holes in the basket. And those holes, everybody knows what the holes are: gambling, overcrowding, etc., disadvantage, remote disadvantage, etc.
Mm-hmm.
It's the job of the families to help fix those holes and to work together as the community to help strengthen their children, their families. The tree is a very symbolic story of culture. Stories come from culture deep down on the roots, and the fruit are the children. So when all the culture stories are listened to, and good practices of law and respect are all lived out in the community, well, then your children have got a much greater chance of growing up strong.
Mm.
And so they see them as the fruit. All the little dots, well, that's just really networking of different family units supporting each other. And some families know some families, not all families know everybody, but coming together. So I guess what we did was, after working with our illness staff for several years, we had all these metaphors on individual laminates from individuals drawing, and then we asked if someone could draw it all together, and one of our team members, family members, could paint.
Mm-hmm.
And with three or four comings and goings and talking about it, that's what she came up with for us. So our Yulnu staff carry these posters around now, and that's how they describe FAST. I guess the way I've seen it, it's effectively your two worldviews, your two evidence bases coming from slightly different understandings, but all working in the same direction.
Mm.
So it's like, you know, the academic, the Western evidence base and the Yulnu evidence base. It's like two PhDs coming together. I'm waiting for someone to come along and want to write it up for me.
Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous. I imagine it's a really effective tool to bring out on team building days and things like that, to have that in front of you and to remind you about, the aims of the program, what you're setting out to do. You could use that in so many ways.
Yep, and I guess what they become are symbols of meaning. Our staff out in East Arnhem will tell us, people in the community, when they hear about the next FAST program coming along, they'll say, oh, we want to be in the FAST canoe.
Ha ha. Gorgeous.
So it becomes a symbol of meaning.
Mm. It's really obvious to me that, you know, you've been working in this program for quite some time now, and there's probably a little bit of a journey for you to get where you are today. I'm wondering if you can fill us in on how it is you arrived in this place doing this work at this time in these communities. Can you give us a bit of a background story?
Yeah, well, without giving too many secrets away, I started life after school as a plumber. I guess I didn't let school get in the way of my education. I found myself, while doing my plumbing apprenticeship, I ended up being given apprentices to work with me as a tradesman that no one else wanted to work with. And I used to, growing up in Sydney, in the middle of Sydney, I'd end up in the inner city working in as a volunteer in drop-in centres when I was 20. And I guess at that point, I had people offering me jobs to become a youth worker, but had strong messages from family influence, no, finish your trade, get your trade. So I think I probably started off in the wrong area. It was great. I loved being the tradesman. It was great learning how to use my hands, but it really wasn't helping me to come alive in terms of mm-hmm. relational skills.
Mm-hmm.
So moving forward a few years, after working for 20 years as a plumber, I went and did a youth working course, a Christian youth working course, and then came back into the Blue Mountains of Sydney and was doing a whole lot of youth work. But I found myself, interestingly enough, at night, because I was, by that stage I was late 30s and not very hip when you're late 30s with teenagers, I found myself actually sitting in the gutter talking to parents at 10 o'clock at night about how to work with their own kids, while my younger, more funky youth workers who were working would hang out with all the kids. So I guess that showed to me a lot about our conventions, about how we approach youth work, and where youth and children sit within families. And it just showed me that's really key, that the family unit is the place that has to be strong, despite a lot of the challenges that a lot of families face as youth and parents go through those complex years of development. Yeah, so back 10 years ago, it's actually 10 years this year that I've been working in FAST up here. My wife is a teacher. She was working in middle-class schools in the Blue Mountains and wanted to change. She wanted to work with Aboriginal kids. We came up here to the Territory where we knew we could get possibly work.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, I got asked to move from that youth working role I was doing to running this family strengthening program. So after a few months, I took it. And then I found myself heading down a path that I would not have thought I was going to 3 or 4 years early.
So when you speak about your drive or your passion, was that something that developed over time once you landed in this kind of role? Or was there something there before that doesn't surprise you about how you've ended up in this place?
Growing up in the, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, in Sydney, in our streets, all the kids just played together on the streets. There's no front fences. Everybody played cricket. We went down the bush for ages at a time. We'd all come back. It was all safe. So there's some things we've really lost from our society these days. In terms of community, we would have our big bonfires every year. The street would come out at Christmas time for parties. So you'd watch the whole street come together and do things. My mother in particular came from a big rural family in northwest New South Wales, and I saw the value of big, broad family. Didn't mean everybody liked each other all the time, but, gee, they loved each other. And so I guess I learned a lot about what community is, and then moving on, working in the Christian organisation, helping to understand more about understanding about who we are and how we're made, I guess. So on one level, it hasn't surprised me. It hasn't surprised other people who've known me, but it just felt a bit left field from plumbing and putting 4 or 5 toilets in people with lots of choice and lots of money in their houses, and then to working up here. So it's been a good journey.
Just picking up on you've already alluded to the fact that some of the important values for you is sense of community, belonging to community, and also the importance of family. Would you say that there are other values that have really shaped how you grew up and are influencing the kind of work that you're doing now?
I think wanting to see the best in people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've done some training in the last few years around conflict resolution, etc., and like an understanding that conflict and problems are not necessarily a negative thing, but to use those things for good to come out of. So I guess there's a lot about hope.
Mm-hmm.
I think I understand a lot about we're not perfect as people, and we're not always at our best, and we make mistakes. So a glue that can hold us together is learning to how, I guess, compassion and mercy, but learning what life is like for another person and taking time to, you know, to listen to people and to, because most people really want the best, but for their own kids, etc., and we want the best for each other, but sometimes we don't always look like that. We get forced back into just survival mode. So I think the value of forgiveness is a really powerful value. And I guess when I use the word value, I mean a value is something for me that it actually drives your behaviour most of the time, not just when you want to or when you feel good, which I find challenging because so I value hospitality and welcoming people, but I'll get rung up at different times and asked for different needs when I don't feel like giving it. So there's a bit of a choice you've got to make then of how much do you extend, how much do you protect yourself from your own tiredness, whatever, but at the same time still work a way to care for those around you at whatever the time of the day it is.
That can be a really complex thing, can't it? These boundaries that we need to be able to set, even though we come with these values of wanting to engage, wanting to listen and be there for people, yet we can become overburdened. So, yeah, how do you negotiate those boundaries with the clients you're working with and, yeah, others that you might be working with?
Over the years, I've had a really good staff and a fairly stable staff. Our funding has allowed for us to have about anywhere between 3 and 6 full-time equivalent positions. So we always work very relationally and very close, and we always check in with each other, work out what's working well, what's not working well. So we've worked very closely together. And I guess we use each other to support each other in terms of making sense of those things. Some of us are able to draw very tight boundaries around our times, and others are not always able to do that. I think it's also about working closely with the people you work with and learning how to understand each other's culture. I guess talking about the Aboriginal world, we do have different worldviews. We do approach things differently when it comes to resources, I guess, is one example. To be honest, I don't think I've worked it out yet. And I think there's a skill in working out how to say no and feeling okay about it. So I think there's a bit of internal work you have to keep doing about you know, just work, I guess just being able to say no to something, but knowing that it's not life-threatening, but my self-esteem or my value or my strength doesn't come from my ability to help somebody. It's working out your internal motivations, and I think when you can piece some of those things together, that can help you to understand why you do what you do as well.
So we're kind of touching on, I guess, some of the challenges and struggles that can come with this kind of work. Can you speak a bit more about, I guess, what's the biggest challenge that you've found in your role as manager of FAST?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because if I reflect on a more personal level, I'll think about my worldview and my cross-cultural processes, and that's really all about me. But when I think a bit more deeply about it, I think it's more about the challenges that some of the people we work with face. So I've got one of those little printouts on the board in front of me all the time that talks the difference between equality and equity. Equality is a nice value, but equity, as I get it, means you have to actually redistribute your resources. But that's not always politically correct, or it doesn't always work well. So I'm conscious that some people, through their circumstances, it's not they need to be fixed, but they need a different level of support to help them to walk with them. A few years ago, one of our staff, I've been working with him for about 5 years, and I've been adopted into the kinship system in East Arnhem. And this fella who works with us, he's a ceremony man in the Jumbapunyu clan in East Arnhem. And he said to me one day, Malu, he called me, which is father. He said, Malu, when you work with us, you don't put a rope around our neck. And that was the most, I got to tell you, that was the most humbling thing anybody has ever said to me. And he's not just saying it to me, he's saying it to FAST. He's saying it to all of our staff, because we all try and work from the same value base. We all try and work from the same practice framework area. And what he was saying was that he's not given the same opportunity everywhere he goes from other organisations, other NGOs or other government departments, etc. So I guess what that showed me is he was seeing something in us, in the way we operate, which was allowing him to be more human, I guess, if I can say that. So that was a fairly profound time, and I often think about it, and I often try and make sense of it, because I can't, coming from the white mainstream dominant culture, I don't live with years of generational trauma. I don't live with the pressures of intervention. I don't live with the complexities of having 10 or 12 people living in our house. I don't live with the lack of choice, that if I want to go down to the shop at any time, I can, because I've got money in the bank. I've got access issues. If I want to ring the taxation office or the bank, it's quite easy for me to do. But many times he will send forms into me that he gets sent from government departments. Malu, can you help me understand what this is about? So I guess when I answer that question, it's some of the disadvantages. I have to look at it from the lens of the people in disadvantage, I would say, and who don't have the same set of resources. And so what can we do within the limitations of the FAST program to redress some of those issues? And I think part of it is one of the reasons I think we get success is because we do work with hope with people. We do work with wanting to work with their assets, and we're not just coming in and telling them what they need.
So what do you think is the lesson there for other NGOs that perhaps are doing things a bit differently to what FAST does? You know, the story you shared just then is quite significant for that individual, that man, to say, you know, you allow me to be more human. What is that telling other organisations that are working differently?
Just another quick little story. I remember going out to one of the East Arnhem communities one time and just sitting at the airport or sitting somewhere and just talking about, you know, engagement with programs, etc. And this person was basically saying to me, yeah, mate, what you need to do is you've got to get yourself a broker. You've got to get yourself an Aboriginal broker, and then once you've got your broker, then you can get in. And it didn't sit with me, and I couldn't process it at the time, but it was a bit of jarring language into my ears. And I guess that's not how we want to work with people. We do value our relationships. We value the fact that we're working with other people. We're not just a service commodity. I guess that's why I strike that language. We're not a service. We're not doing service delivery. Our FAST program, I think, has real challenges for our sector, for the NGO sector. Our Fair Work Australia laws make it so complex to do work. You've almost got to, for families to get support and to have problems, they've got to have them between 8 o'clock and 5 o'clock in the daytime, because it's really difficult for our organisations to negotiate how to find that balance between caring for their staff, but at the same time allowing them to work well in a flexible way. Thankfully, my staff, this might sound a bit paternal as well, but I think we do try and work with a mission approach as much as we do with a vocation approach, which is could be a bit controversial, I know, but that's what it is. I'll have other illness staff, and you'll watch them work with other Ballander staff, mainstream staff, and they'll say, oh, I don't trust that one. And they know, they can pick up through their skin who they trust and who they don't trust. Mm. But there's all these different agencies and organisations running around with their programs that they're trying to slot in.
Can you name, I guess, some skills or abilities or particular knowledge that you bring to the work that's been most helpful in overcoming some of these challenges that you speak about?
I'm always really surprised whenever I go and do any trainings around trauma training, around youth working training, around support programs, how little the training teaches people about self-awareness and understanding where their own drivers come from and understanding where their own needs. And I guess answering a statement, I'm okay when. So if I'm a manager and I'm saying I'm okay when everything's working neatly and I'm not okay the rest of the time, well, I'm going to be in trouble because life's complex. Mm. So I guess I really try and bring that in with my staff, helping them to process, to understand when they're getting upset about something, what's actually getting upset, to be able to manage yourself when things don't go the way you planned. So I guess as a manager, I try to bring understanding around that. Mm-hmm. I try to bring a lot of understanding. As much as we're not community development, pure community development, I do try and bring in learnings and understandings around, well, community development is about listening to the people and helping them to do for them what they can do for themselves, not just hand out. Yeah, I guess one of the things we want to do really significantly is actually make space for people. And that's really hard because we work within funding time frames that just don't allow a slowness of pace, of lifestyle. Yeah, so yeah, that's a few clues to the skills and abilities. We'll actually start most mornings in the Darwin office here, and we will sit and we'll meet. We'll actually pray together. We'll remind, and just through stories and illustrations, we want to remind ourselves of our values, of why we do what we do, so how we can not only support each other but then make a difference in other people's lives at different levels. So we're very conscious about talking about that. Mm-hmm. We have a weekly meeting where we start with what's working well, what's something you can work on differently this week. So it's really trying to take a strengths-based approach to things as well.
Beautiful. And just on that, can you share a story, a sparkling moment? What's a story that stands out to you as something that you're particularly proud of?
Look, there's many stories and many illustrations, but when I see somebody experiencing the FAST program and then reflecting on their own choices as a parent and then putting in significant choices and making a shift in their family structure, I feel that it's worthwhile. So we had a lady in a program here in Palmerston a few years ago, just one of the suburbs of Darwin, and families sit around a table and chairs and actually have a meal together. And we don't encourage them to have their phones or any sort of electronic information, but just have a conversation together. And at the next year, when she came and joined the team as a teacher in the school, she said to me, one of the reasons I'm back here is because I went out and bought a table for my single daughter and I to sit around and talk every night for dinner.
Oh, wow.
As opposed to just sitting on the couch with our bowl of food in our hand and just watching TV. So I thought, wow, that's, for me, that's how I've been brought up. You're brought up to sit around a table. I'm not saying it's right for everybody, but she made choices for herself about assessing her own needs. It's really self-efficacy. A few weeks ago, we had 60 people in one remote community for the first night of the FAST program, and 70 people in another program where we've been running for about 6 years, 7 years. And in both of those communities, I had other service providers and the schools, just some individuals, not all members of the school staff coming up, but some school staff coming up and saying, Mel, what are you doing? What are you doing that brings those numbers in, and why? It's not just about the food you're giving out. And say, yep, you're absolutely right. And for me, it loops back into those, all of those things we've been talking around our practice, around our values, and the underpinning of the program, the underpinning design. So I guess that might sound funny, but that was a bit of a sparkle moment for me, and again, humbling to say, yep, we are on the right track, or there are some very good things about what we're doing that's working well.
I'm interested in hearing about perhaps some of your mentors or some of your people that you might look up to or have influenced, I guess, your practice along the way. Who might they be?
There's probably no one particular person. I guess at various stages of my life, I've been able to identify different people who've been there and speak into. Interestingly enough, there was one person in particular when I was going to high school, and a few friends of mine used to walk home from school. How far did we walk? It was about 3 or 4 kilometres. We'd walk home every afternoon. We were all going to the local church at the time, and he moved into the church rectory, this youth leader. He was about 5 years older than us. And so what he would do, he would invite us into the church rectory every afternoon, and we'd come and just have a glass of water. And I can't remember what we ate, sort of, if we did. But I guess what it showed me is that there was an older person willing to take interest in me. And so I really appreciated that. So that fella in particular has stuck in my mind as somebody. So I guess I've watched him over the years and thought, yeah, that's the sort of thing that I aspire to do as well, to make space for other people. I know as a Christian person, there was a whole lot of values for him around what it means to love people, to have mercy, to, you know, and to want people to grow and to learn. So I guess that's a framework he would have as his Christian faith. And that's, I guess I started adopting that as a teenager then, and I could see that for myself as well.
So what was this fella's name?
Stephen.
Stephen. If Stephen was with us now, what stories do you think he would tell me about the ways that you've taken on board this Christian love that he showed in his life? What do you think he would say about the work you're doing now?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I catch up with him about once every 3 or 4 years, because he's in Sydney and I'm up here, so we just sometimes bump into each other at different social events. I think he'd be quietly pleased. I've let him know over the years that I think he, when I was a young teenager, he was quite significant in my development, and I guess helping, and I didn't realise it, I didn't have the language at the time, but he was helping my self-esteem. He was helping me to feel okay about myself, because he showed love and care to me, which is a journey, isn't it? It's not just a one-off tablet you take. It's about being supported by a whole school of people. I guess the other time when I was in my mid-30s, I'd been working for 20 years as a plumber. My wife was having our third child, and we decided to go down to do the youth and community work in a Christian community in Tasmania. It was a live-in certificate for residential, which then turned into doing a diploma. And I chose to then stay down longer. My wife was on maternity leave, and we asked the school if she could stay away longer, and we did. And part of my intention there was because there was a whole lot of men there who I really liked the way they operate, again, for similar reasons about Stephen. And so I took that as an opportunity to learn. And then it was that organisation that taught me a lot about people skills, taught me a lot about listening, taught me a lot about empathy, taught me a lot about interpersonal relationships, team building, all those sorts of dynamics. And then when I got offered this FAST program, which is all around working with volunteers and building teams and empowering small groups of people to go out and do things, I'd already had a whole lot of equipping training, if that makes sense, and practice at it.
So what does the future hold for you, Mel? Where's the work taking you next in terms of, you know, all these wonderful values and skills and knowledge that you've learned along the way? How do you think that's going to play out in the future?
Good bit of disclosure is always a good thing. I don't have a degree. I don't have a qualification to speak of. So there's a whole lot of jobs I could not even apply for. But I watch people who are in jobs where they can apply because they've got qualifications, and I can see they do not operate with a framework that I do.
Yeah, and that's interesting.
I find that amazing in our life that that's how we roll and that's how we work. So on one level, there's part of me that worries. Like, for example, if I went back down to return back to Sydney where our family is, which we'll probably do one day, I'm not sure how I'll be seen going into NGOs because I don't have qualifications. But I've been managing, looking after, you know, a small staff of 10 or 12 people with 100 team members, what, 200 team members a year, engaging over 1,000 families a year, and with all of the complexities of that.
Well, the fact that I'm talking to you now, and this is being broadcast to social workers effectively, the reason I'm interviewing you is because you bring all the values and ethics and skills that are needed in work like this, and that you have a great story to share, a real success story. And it just goes to show you don't need to hold that piece of paper to be able to do good work. So, yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? Thanks for talking to us today and sharing that. And raising that interesting issue.
I think I learnt again from other times where I was in young leadership and being mentored by older leaders that people were saying you don't actually have to have all the skills to be a good leader, but you do need to know what you need to gather around you to help you. So, for example, the FAST program has a very, very complex psychometric evaluation tool. Social workers and people who work in the field are quite amazed at the rigour of our evaluation tool. But we can't use it in our remote communities. No. So we've had to work out how to design a tool that captures the understanding of our programs, etc. You know, I go to academics in town here. We go to academics around the country and work with their knowledge, etc. And so on a couple of occasions, I've actually been able to present at conferences with other academics who actually know how to do the writing. They know how to speak in the academic world and journal article world, etc. It's a bit like we joked with one fella about the gentleman and the scholar. You know, as we work together, there's a lady at the moment doing a PhD on around our evaluation work over the years and how we've learned how to do it. Well, in return, she's going to do a journal article. Well, that's fantastic because we've got the story and she's got the writing ability. Mm-hmm. So it's about knowing what your strengths are and your skills and then bringing them all together.
Yeah, it sounds like you're really able to traverse those two worlds between what's happening on the ground and what's happening at an academic level and being able to be in the middle somewhere.
Which is a really complex space, and even working from the territory to down south, it's a different paradigm. And also each of our individual, so we will take our Yolnu trainers and take them from East Arnhem to West Arnhem. And they're going on to another country. They're like a fish out of water there in terms of different symbols, different understandings. So it takes them a while to also cross those barriers. So it's not just us. It's all of our staff processing like that as well.
Yeah. So just in reflection, as we come to a time at the end, what do you think's been your biggest learning? And how might the people listening to this podcast who might be looking to practice in remote Indigenous communities with vulnerable families, how might that knowledge benefit them?
Another person once said to me, after working up here for many years, he said the more he knew, the more he realised he didn't know. I guess for me, a really key thing is being humble about knowing what you do know and what you don't know. I can be a bit passionate and get a bit and want to advocate. So it's working out when I'm advocating for someone or with somebody. I think that's really important to work out. I just don't want to take up a cause, but I want to work with those whose issue it's affecting. I've learned other things along the way in my training. As a little mantra I say to myself, a facilitator trainer will not do for the team member what the team member can do for themselves. I think there's a lot of people in our sector who are rescuers, and that actually doesn't help. It doesn't build capacity. They might feel good about what they're doing, but they're actually not helping. So that's really challenging space, and those conversations need to be had. That comes back to that self-reflection. Like, and I guess for me, I've had a range of different staff members working with us, from teachers through to youth workers through to people with community development qualifications. They all bring a skill. They all bring a different framework. They all bring processes. And so it's allowing space and the skills of for people to rise. We talk a lot about transferable skills. Yeah.
I'd like to go back to something that you said very early in our conversation, the comments of Viktor Frankl. If you know your why, you'll find your how. If I was to ask you to describe your why in one or two sentences, what would that be?
I guess I believe that as humans, we're created in God's image, and the God I understand from the Bible and my Christian faith teaches me about a God of justice and mercy, a God of love. And I believe that as man and woman, we're created in God's image. And you can see this in Genesis. It talks about that man is made to be loving. He's made to be truthful. He's made to be creative. He's made to be responsible. So I guess my why is being invited into that journey to help other people go on that journey and to fellowship and have community with those around me at whatever level that looks like. So I guess that's part of my why, I think.
Just in finishing up, is there anything else that we have missed that I should have asked that you'd like to share before we finish up?
Yeah, let me read out a quote. And this quote came from Elko Island, one of the elders, when they saw the FAST program. And this quote goes, "It is like the FAST program is written for us and our people. This is like the way it used to be for us. We are excited that FAST will help us, our children and our community, go back to the way how we used to work together with each other and walk alongside our children to teach them the proper way." So every so often we get a quote like that from our team members out in community that just helps us to understand our why, and then that pushes us to keep working through the challenges and the barriers and to go forward with FAST in this time and space. We also know, Lucy, I think this is one thing I don't think I mentioned, that one of the underpinnings of FAST, it's very intergenerational. So it is about grandparents and parents and children all in together. So incredibly on a cross-cultural level because people would say to us, oh, how do you take a program that's designed in North America and make that work in Australia? That's not teaching culture. Hello, it is teaching culture. It's reflecting culture because it's intergenerational. It's those really powerful underpinning ingredients that help be the natural attractors and then engagement processes. Yeah, so I'm really appreciative to the people who thought a lot about FAST 30-odd years ago in North America from Wisconsin University, came up with this set of activities, which are all well thought out.
Okay, so if people would like to read more about FAST and where it's come from, where could they go?
FAST-NT has a website. FAST Australia has a website. In the last few years, I have two colleagues, one who works for an NGO in Perth, another fellow works for an NGO in Hobart, and we've actually made an alliance between us with our three NGOs, and we hold the license for the FAST program with the states, like with the parent body in North America. So FAST Australia has a website.
Fantastic. All right. So I'll put a link to those in the show notes. And if people want to follow up with you personally, maybe connect with you online or directly, how might they go about doing that?
Best way, just send me an email.
All right. And we'll put your email address in the show notes as well. Sounds great.
Yep. Fantastic.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Mel, for talking to us today and sharing what is really deep insight into who you are and what you bring to the work up there in the Northern Territory. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphorically-speaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphorically-speaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.